For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Shira Springer. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, we're reviewing this year's biggest discoveries, hits, and stories we loved, starting with health and science, including the Nobel Prize for a discovery that proved Albert Einstein right, and a new cancer treatment.
This is a breakthrough therapy, and patients and all of us here at Mass General are really excited about it.
And we look at how sports and politics collided this year, going beyond the Patriots' historic comeback victory in Super Bowl 51.
I just want to relax, turn my brain off, and watch the blackest city in America beat the most racist city I've ever been to.
Plus,
my left stroke just went viral.
Right stroke put a baby in a
the best of the year's music.
We like to keep it on the high note. It's levels to it, you and I know. Tell them be humble.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Shira Springer. In these final days of 2017, we're taking a look back at a particularly newsy year. First up, the year in health and science. And with me to hit the high notes is Carrie Goldberg, host of WBUR's Common Health blog. Welcome, Carrie.
Thank you, Shira. And before we even get to the actual news highlights, I'd just like to submit that this has been a very painful year for me as a health and science reporter.
Wait, why? It hasn't seemed like that bad a year. I mean, when it comes to health and science, there have been a lot of breakthroughs and, as I recall, a lot of life-changing work being done.
Yeah, I mean, it's been fine, actually, for that sense. But it's just that, you know, I see part of reporting on health as sharing information that helps people live healthier lives. And I've just been very uncomfortably aware this year that for many people, the news itself has not been good for their health.
Okay, so you're talking about the people who are get really stressed out about the divisions in the country right now, the politics that's sort of getting everybody a little bit aggravated. I know there's something called the Trump 10 that people have been packing on because of just the stress all around them.
It is. It's very stressful. It's particularly stressful to feel like we're not even all working from the same facts anymore, right? Mm-hmm. Like we can't agree on them. And so it's taking a toll on people's mental health, physical health. And I hate the idea that we in news are contributing to that. I mean, no one says to stop covering the news, but still, I'd just like to propose that for this year in review that we're doing right now, that we focus mainly, though, of course, not exclusively, on positive news.
Okay, I get it. So we're the antidote, so to speak, to a year of what has been really stressful news generally.
Right. So emphasize the positive. And I think, you know, the big picture is that, as you said, this has not been a bad year at all in health and medical news, right?
Yeah, I mean, when I think of that, I was like, there's no news, as in, like, there's been no new outbreak for the world to worry about. No new Ebola in Africa. And I remember last year we were so concerned about the spread of Zika. No new Zika virus in the Southern Hemisphere. I mean, that's really good stuff.
Yeah, so it's a no news is good news kind of a situation. I mean, there's a bad outbreak of cholera in Yemen right now. But what I'm trying to say is that there's been no big new infectious disease to worry about. And here's even a little encouraging note about measles. You know, the World Health Organization says that deaths from measles have fallen below 100,000 a year for the first time since they've been keeping track. And the New York Times reports that as recently as in the 1980s, measles was killing 2.6 million people a year.
Wow. So you can see with that 2.6 million people how health officials get so concerned about, you know, when vaccination rates drop.
Yeah, like, let's not go back there. But and speaking of vaccinations, one of the health stories that struck me the most this year is that there's a new shingles vaccine coming onto the market in the next few weeks that's much more effective than the previous one and approved for people 50 and over. Here's Dr. Ben Kreskel. He's the chief of infectious diseases at Atrius Health.
I am by nature very skeptical about medications, including vaccines. And I have to say, this one looks awfully good. And I will get it as soon as it is available and recommended by my primary care physician.
And Shira, I have to say, I will too. I think this vaccine can make you feel kind of fluish and yucky for a couple of 3 days. But, you know, one third of us gets shingles at some point, usually later in life, and it can have long-term complications, including pain.
Yeah. And so if I remember correctly, shingles is the reactivation of the chickenpox virus, right? So that's really relevant for anyone, including myself, who had chickenpox as a kid, right?
Right.
And
correct.
So, okay, so what other health and medical news would you highlight? What was really on your radar? And you know, let's not forget, actually, what was a highlight for me was you were the lead reporter on WBUR's cancer series. And this moment in cancer. And so let's start there. What was the biggest cancer news this year?
Well, so I asked a few local cancer specialists, and they all, surprisingly enough, said the same thing on that. Here's Mara Bloom. She's the director of the Massachusetts General Hospital Cancer Center.
That would have to be CAR T cells, hands down. This is a breakthrough therapy, and patients and all of us here at Mass General are really excited about it.
And that excitement is throughout the cancer world. You know, this is big news. It's a new type of weapon in the arsenal against cancer. And even though right now it's only relevant to a few thousand people with blood cancers, but still, it's a step forward. The FDA approved the first two types of CAR T for those people with blood cancers this year.
Okay, so again, if I'm recalling correctly, the T in CAR T refers to our T cells, right? And they're the key soldiers, so to speak, in our immune system.
Correct. And if you must know, CAR, the CAR part of it stands for chimeric antigen receptor. But really,
I'm impressed.
Thank you. I actually wrote that down. But all you really need to know is that with CAR T therapies, they take your own T cells and they reprogram or re-engineer them so they can be used against your cancer. And this is a piece of a much bigger trend called immunotherapy, which is harnessing the patient's own immune system. That's definitely, clearly, immunotherapy is the most exciting trend in cancer right now.
Yeah, I think I read one patient who was a beneficiary of CAR T likened it to Pac-Man gobbling up the bad cells.
That's right. That's right.
And also, if I remember, former President Jimmy Carter was one of the big beneficiaries, or sort of the poster child of this immunotherapy.
Of immunotherapy more broadly, right. He had advanced melanoma. And so, you know, it's very encouraging also that in some of these, the very latest findings on immunotherapy, that the remissions that it can bring on can last for years.
Still, I haven't heard anybody saying that it's a cure for cancer.
No,
why
and you
not?
Never will. You will never hear. No, like, no, immunotherapy, including CAR T therapy, is really only helping a small subset of cancer patients. And really, if there's one thing I learned from doing the series this year, it's that we can't expect a cure for cancer. You know, cancer isn't one disease, as everybody says. It's 100 diseases or actually way more than that, because researchers are figuring out that every tumor has unique mutations, unique genes.
And so, speaking of genetics, what's the big DNA news this year?
Well, I would say continued progress on CRISPR, which I think many of us now know is this revolutionary gene editing tool. And there are expectations that there could be clinical trials used to try it to correct genetic diseases pretty soon. And also, Chair, I just have to share that I heard that CRISPR was on Jeopardy. And the clue was a gene editing tool that sounds like a refrigerator drawer.
So that's really how you know something a scientist has made it to the big time. It's a Jeopardy answer.
That's right. That's how you know. And I would also highlight continued progress on gene therapy. So that's using genetic engineering to try to actually fix genes that cause disease in people. And earlier this month, the FDA approved a type of gene therapy that targets a rare type of inherited blindness.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And that's considered the first FDA approval of a gene therapy to treat an inherited disease. It uses a modified virus to ferry healthy genes into the eyes of these blind patients.
This is absolutely astounding stuff. And this is a big part of the sort of the comeback for gene therapy,
yeah,
right?
Gene therapy is roaring back. And by the way, it includes those CAR T therapies we were talking about. They're considered gene therapy, too. There are a lot of hopes around gene therapy.
They're really expensive, right? That's
yes.
What I'm hearing.
Yes, they're really expensive. So CAR T therapies run $300,000 or $400,000 or even $500,000.
Oh,
and this blindness gene therapy could be as much as $1 million.
Oh, my gosh. That's steep. So,
yeah.
Okay, you've given a nice sort of shot in the arm of positive health news.
That's why I like it.
Yes, I know. I'm all behind this positive spin on the health news this year. But can we go a little negative now?
Yeah. So the negative news would be, first of all, the really disturbing news that American life expectancy has dropped slightly for the second year in a row.
So, okay, give me some of those stats.
So the numbers came out last week, and they show that life expectancy stays the same for women, but it dropped again for men by a couple of months. And it's pretty clear what the major cause is. It's the opioids.
Yeah,
the opioids crisis. And because deaths from drug overdoses jumped by another 21% last year.
And but we've got an opioid overdose rate of something like 5 or 6 people a day. So we obviously need to do much better in that department.
We do. Although we did have some relatively good news last month, which was that here in Massachusetts, in the first 9 months of this year, our state death rate dropped by about maybe 10%. And it does look like Massachusetts is doing a few things right. More treatment, more careful prescribing, more use of naloxone, the drug that you give right away when someone's having an opioid overdose.
And other good news for Massachusetts was that we were ranked the healthiest state in the country overall for the first time. We beat out Hawaii, which on a day like today is quite surprising.
I think we get extra credit for that. Yes, it's this report called the American Health Rankings. And you probably figure, well, it's because we have almost universal health insurance.
That's what I would think, yes.
Yep, but it's also we also get high marks for low obesity rates, low rates of children living in poverty. And we have a surprisingly large number, although you wouldn't know it when you're looking for one, but we have a lot of mental health providers and lots of primary care doctors and dentists.
Wow. Okay. So I'd like to raise a health topic that struck me this year because I do a lot of sports coverage, and that's concussions. It's been a big topic over the last couple of years in professional sports.
Yeah.
But in September, researchers at Boston University's Chronic Traumatic Encephalopathy Center, and that's a tough CTE, as we like to say in the sports biz, yes, reported findings that kids who play tackle football under the age of 12 may, now listen to this, this is statistic just shocked me, may double their risk of developing behavioral problems and triple their chances of suffering depression later in life.
Wow.
It really makes you think.
And that's, I assume, because they take all these repetitive hits to the head?
Yeah, exactly. It is because they take all these repetitive hits to the head. And I think the important thing to bring out of that, we're not talking about concussions here.
Right.
We're talking about subconcussive hits.
Wow.
So these aren't diagnosed concussions. These aren't things where, you know, you see a player sort of sprawled out, a young player sprawled out on the field. These are perhaps the little hits you may get in practice or the hits that may go, you know, unnoticed in a game, but they accumulate. And these young developing brains really, really suffer as a result.
So what can this mean for youth football?
Well, it's interesting. The study didn't recommend any policy or rule changes, but one of the study's lead authors, BU professor Robert Stern, I had the opportunity to speak to him, and he said that, you know, he was at a point, given all of the research out there, that he doesn't think kids should play tackle football. And here's what he said.
We have to step back and say, you know, we parents do really amazing things to protect our kids. And yet, we then drop them off in a playing field when they're 6, 7 years old and put a big plastic helmet and face mask on them and say, go at it. Hit your head over and over and over again. Forgetting that inside that head is the most precious organ we have, our brain.
So, I mean, sure, I guess if we're trying to stay positive, the good thing about all this research coming out is that it lets parents and players make more informed decisions, right?
Exactly. I mean, I think that's the big takeaway. The more we know about the dangers of concussions and subconcussive hits, the more players and, like I said, parents can make more informed decisions. And in fact, we are seeing that happen. Another study that came out was by Anne McKee. She's a neuropathologist with BU, and she examined the brains of 202 football players. 111 of those played in the NFL. 110 tested positive for CTE, and as we all know, that's the brain disease that can result in depression, dementia, memory loss. And in the wake of that, you know, NFL players were really considering whether they wanted to continue playing. And in fact, one 26-year-old player for the Baltimore Ravens did retire. But it should be said he went on to pursue a PhD full time at MIT. So he had other things going.
Well, and he had such a beautiful brain, I guess.
Yes,
he didn't
exactly.
want to hurt it,
exactly. Right? Mm-hmm. So let's switch from health to science. What was the biggest science news of the year?
Okay, that's easy. So that would be improved detection of gravitational waves. And in fact, the 2017 Nobel Prize in Physics went to the scientist who captured gravitational waves. Here's a very trippy bit of sound.
That's the chirp we've been looking for.
So that little chirp is the sound of two black holes colliding and releasing gravitational waves. And Einstein's theory of general relativity predicted that when anything with mass accelerates, it should create a wave in the fabric of space-time. Well, last year in 2016, for the first time, instruments were able to detect the collision of two black holes that happened over a billion years ago. And the collision of those black holes sent a big ripple outward, creating waves that were detected by scientists at LIGO, the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory.
Wow, is all I have to
it's
say.
So cool.
It's just really mind-blowing in many ways. Yeah. And we just heard the voice in that previous cut of MIT professor and member of LIGO, of the LIGO team, Nurgis Mvavvala, a great name, who was on Radio Boston last year. And here's what she said.
It's a ripple in space-time. So one of the things Einstein taught us was that empty space, you know, space that's just empty and dark, it still has certain properties. And among the things that empty space can do is it can warp and curve and ripple. And so these are ripples of the space-time itself.
So this all will hopefully make for some exciting discoveries in 2018, right?
Yes. And it is already changing how astronomers are working, actually. It's starting to be applied in astronomy. It's very cool. And Tira, one other science note I'd add. This was the year that science got more politicized than it's been in a very long time. I've personally never seen anything like the March for Science that was held in April here in Boston and in other cities around the world.
Well, let's end on that positive note, Carrie Goldberg. You run our Common Health blog and report on health and science here at WBR. Carrie, thank you so much for joining us and educating us.
My pleasure. You're welcome.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Shira Springer, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Shira Springer. As we race toward the end of 2017, let's take a moment to look back at the year in sports in Boston and beyond. There were big games and big wins for local teams, but so much of the sports world collided with social issues and politics this year. So joining me now is Bob Ryan, a longtime colleague at the Boston Globe. Now, Bob, I know you like to refer to yourself as a Boston Globe sports columnist emeritus, but we can still read your columns regularly in the Globe on Sundays. And we can hear you wax poetic about sports as host of Bob Ryan's Boston podcast. Bob, thank you for joining me in the studio
today. Oh, it's great to see you again, Shira.
Likewise. So let's start with what was probably the highlight for many Boston fans this year, when the Patriots won their seventh Super Bowl championship in Houston last February. I was on hand for that game. They came back. It was a historic comeback victory. They came back from a 28-3 deficit in the second half. Here's some sound from that game.
Ooh. Toss to White. He's in! Patriots win the Super Bowl! Brady has his fifth! What a comeback!
That last touchdown right on the line of the end zone. You've seen a lot of big moments in sports, big wins. So where does this Super Bowl victory rank?
The problem is that the trauma and ranking.
Yeah.
These Patriots, seven Super Bowls in the Brady Belichick era. They have won five, they have lost two. Every game was competitive. Every game was decided late. It could be 0-7 without any problem. They could be 7-0, and they're 5-2. The drama in this one, it is the greatest comeback in Super Bowl history. The numbers The number combination 28 and 3 are not going to be popular, locker room combinations on your locker, in Atlanta. They're already being taunted, by other people during the course of this football season with people holding up signs and such when the Falcons play.
Yeah, it's become sort of a shorthand,
28-3,
right?
28-3. People are going to go to their graves, with the most least popular combination of numbers in Atlanta will be 28-3. Of course it was spectacular, and they looked like they had no chance of stopping Atlanta in the beginning, but we are so used now to the spectacular, to the unpredictable, to the drama that Brady and company had generate, and consider their last two Super Bowl victories, that traumatic losses, wonderful exhilarating wins, but maybe even bigger to the world at large. I don't think the Seahawks have ever gotten over what happened at the end of that game. Truly, they've not come back. And Atlanta seemed to have a horrible hangover at the beginning of the year. They did rebound later on. But of course, it was exhilarating. But I'll say this. The one in Seattle was even more startling. I got to tell a very quick story now. I know it's 2 years ago. But I'm sitting with a bunch of people at home watching the game. And here it goes. Marshawn Lynch gets down to 1 yard line. You know the game's over. You know it's going in. And here, all of a sudden, he's passing. Then it's, who's Malcolm Butler? I had no idea. So that moment jumps out at me a little bit ahead of what happened last year.
So you mentioned Atlanta's Super Bowl hangover this year. The Patriots got off to a bit of a shaky start. This was a team that everybody in the preseason had sort of predicted undefeated.
Some people talking undefeated.
Exactly. And now, it was a loss in the season opener when they hung the banner or unveiled the banner.
Yeah.
Now look where we are. Well, is there any surprise that this is where this team is?
They take punches in the mouth and shrug them off and come back and go about their business better than any team in professional sport. That was a punch in the mouth. Kansas City ran all over them. They didn't appear to have any hope of stopping them defensively. And their defense was, in fact, a mess. Even the next week they come back, they win 36-20. They give up a lot of yards, but not a lot of points. That's been the theme this year, by the way. They give up yards, but they don't give up points. They're very good inside the hallowed red zone. How about Buffalo in 120 minutes of football did not get a touchdown, offensive touchdown, against the Patriots? They fixed some of that problem on defense and have come around. And it's just another sensational year for the Patriots.
Where it looks like they're headed right back to the Super Bowl.
They have a very good chance.
Of course, in Minneapolis, of all places, which will be another interesting story in 2018. But I think one of the real big stories in the NFL this year was not only what happened on the game, but what happened on the sidelines.
Correct.
And you know exactly what I'm talking about. The protests that were inspired by what Colin Kaepernick did, a season ago, with the kneeling during the national anthem and protesting racial inequality. And also, we can tie it into the Super Bowl with the Patriots because, there were several Patriots who declined to go to the White House.
Yes.
So what do you make of what has happened with the protest movement in the NFL?
I underestimated the scope of it in terms of its deleterious effect on attendance and interest in the league. I poo-pooed it, but I think so. There's been some evidence that it has had a negative effect on the league. That there are surprising number of white fans who have turned this into something completely opposite, but away from what it originally intended to be. They've made this into a litmus test on loyalty and patriotism and the military, a referendum on your love for the military, which is was the farthest thing from Colin Kaepernick's mind when he took the knee originally a year ago. And it's been his whole point has been hijacked in a sense,
And I was going to say, is part of the reason it's been hijacked in a sense because, early this season, President Trump sort of stoked the fires. And we can actually hear what President Trump said that may have gotten fans more riled up.
Wouldn't you love to see one of these NFL owners, when somebody disrespects our flag, to say, get that son of a off the field right now, out, he's fired. He's fired!
At the time he did that, the flame was going out.
Yes.
I truly believe, and I'm not alone in this thought, that it would have died a very quiet and peaceful death, and things would have gone along very nicely had POTUS not injected himself that night in Alabama into this discussion. There is no question in my mind that he created what was That was the match. That was the match in the gas tank, whatever, and that was it for the 2018. Absolutely, I believe that.
So let's turn to other moments where sort of racial inequality or racial incidents were addressed. Again, this collision of politics and sports this year, which was such a big theme. We have to go to Fenway, and we have to go to the Adam Jones incident yeah. in May. Just to remind listeners, Jones played for the Baltimore Orioles, and while he was at Fenway during a game, he said he was called the N-word and hit with a bag of peanuts. Then the next night, a fan referred to a Kenyan woman who was singing the national anthem with a racial slur. That fan, to the Red Sox credit, was banned for life mm-hmm. from Fenway Park. And then in September, you had protesters unfurl a banner over the Green Monster that read, "Racism is as American as baseball." I mean, it was a bit of a really wild year, but in some respects, though, in many respects, Fenway and the Red Sox are no stranger to these types
well,
of
the problem,
racial incidents,
again,
given their history.
Boston has an unfortunate history and reputation.
We always reference Pumpsy Green Jackie Robinson trial at this
well
point.
Earned, yeah. Well earned over the previous decades. And I do think things are much better. I think we can cite chapter and verse about this athlete and that athlete being quite popular amongst people of all colors in Boston. But it would be very naive of any white person to think that racism is extinct. It's ridiculous. And things like this remind you that it is not extinct, that racism is still part of the fabric of not just Boston, but America. And though things are better, and they are, they're not perfect, and they're far from perfect. If this happened in any other city, it wouldn't have gotten the attention it got because there goes Boston. It's back to and people here have to learn to live. We have had to learn to live with this reputation. I thought we were doing better. What's the percentage of that we're talking about? I don't know. I don't know what the percentage is. By the way, there are people who are trying to. Say that it never happened. I don't know what the truth is, whether it happened or it didn't happen. But the fact is that people believe it happened, and that's all that matters.
How did you feel about the Red Sox response to all this? I mean, the ban for life, and then they organized this Take the Lead initiative where they're going to try to, make Fenway more open to create jobs for minority.
That's a good idea.
Residents.
I mean, when you go to Fenway and I do, honest to God, I do this sometimes. I'm a season ticket holder, and I'll sit there every night, not every night, some nights, and look around, just trying to see, do I see a black face? I don't think that large swaths of the local black community just inherently eliminate Fenway from the night out or day out because they don't feel comfortable.
Do you think that'll change with Alex Cora as the
manager?
I
hope that would be – it's a good step forward. I don't know how much direct effect
first,
something
– First, we should mention the first Hispanic manager.
He's a Puerto Rican who went to college in America at University of Miami, is wonderfully bilingual. I mean, his English is impeccable. He's going to bring a different flavor to the whole enterprise. I think it's a wonderful idea. I was lobbied for him as much as I could. In a sense, with my tweets and stuff from the beginning, I'm happy he got the job. I don't know if this is going to have a direct effect, but I mean, this transcends sports, obviously, but it's connected, as you said, they're connected, and Boston, for this to happen in Boston, was discouraging, and it is a setback because I do think some progress have been made in this regard in Boston. We're a long way from the Bill Russell era when someone broke into his house and smeared feces on his wall. But are we as far away as we want to be? Not yet.
You bring up Bill Russell and the Celtics. Let's turn to the Celtics, but in a different vein. This was supposed to be the big year for the Celtics, and then Gordon Hayward.
5 minutes.
I know, 5 minutes. Gruesome leg injury, first quarter of the season opener in Cleveland, and it was panic, all is lost. And then wait, hold on. Fast forward to today, the Celtics are the top team in the Eastern Conference. They had a near record-breaking winning streak, and they are doing this without Gordon Hayward, who there seems like there might be a slight chance of him returning before the end of the season. So should we be surprised, or is this, what you would expect from Kyrie Irving, also a new acquisition, and mastermind Brad Stevens, the coach?
I wasn't expecting anything as dramatic as a 16-game winning streak, and I do think what we're seeing now as they have struggled over the last 21 games and with a 500-ish record is a little bit of a market correction, okay? That was a wonderful streak. It gave them a good cushion for the rest of the season. They still have deficiencies, but they're they're on the right path. Mm-hmm. They're on the right path. The great thing about this team is the youth factor, that the reigning player in point of service is 23 years old. That is Marcus Smart. That the star of the team is 25.
Jason Tatum
is 19 years old.
It's crazy.
And he plays,
plays like a 25-year-old, right? Like a 6 or 7 year veteran.
Positively, the last Celtic rookie that had this kind of and young player had this kind of poise was McHale, who struck me as a second year that he'd been like a 10-year veteran. This kid is uncommonly poised and he's immensely gifted. And next year, here comes Hayward, you know. And so there, whatever happens this year, I don't think they're going to win a championship. I still think Cleveland's going to get better and better, and Cleveland will make a move, I promise you. The Celtics may make a move also. They have an $8 million so-called exception that they can exercise up to February, and they may very well find a shooter that they need to help them. But the future, they're in good shape.
So we've gone from a year in review to a crystal ball outlook.
All right, but let's go back the year. Let's pay homage to a wonderful figure that I hope will never be forgotten in the history of Boston sports.
Isaiah Thomas,
absolutely.
Right? Yes.
What Isaiah Thomas did and accomplished here should never be forgotten. And I don't like the
affinity he had for the city, which was so poignant, and playing after his sister died in the car. I mean, there was probably no more emotion. I mean, more off the field moment in the sense that it happened off the field, but that was probably an emotional high, you know, in terms of the respect the crowd showed when he came back and played, you know, days after. I think it was a day and a half after the news of his sister's death.
It was so much fun to watch, and I marveled at his skill and how many times he would go to the basket and I'd say, oh, this one's going down his esophagus, and he would find a way to spin it up off the glass with his right hand, maybe, or he's left-handed, and he had one of the great offhands I've ever seen. Yeah, I don't like the way it ended. I don't like the fact that, he feels bitter. He does. He feels that Danny, you know, he didn't like when
Danny
admitted that part of the reason he traded him was the bad hip. I don't wish Danny had never said that. Anyway, let's not forget what he did.
Yes, and as someone who's 5'2", I got to embrace the little guys on the court. So I want to, though, turn to women in sports.
Yes.
Which is, you know, is a topic close to my heart and that I care very deeply about. And I think for me, one of the standout stories was, again, that intersection of politics and sports, was the U.S. women's national hockey team threatening to boycott the 2017 World Hockey Championships, which were going to take place and did take place in Michigan, so a home championship. And they were doing it because basically they wanted more respect. They wanted to close the pay gap between what they earned and what the men's team earned. And in addition to that, they wanted better travel accommodations. Yeah. They wanted better development, support for development programs for young girls who wanted to play hockey. And they got what they wanted. Mm. You know, in a new 4-year deal, they got it.
There were two sports where American women are better in the context of their world than their male counterparts. And one is hockey and one is soccer. And they have brought great glory to America throughout the world with their exploits. And they deserved everything that they asked for, and I'm so happy that they got it. I mean, they are – so I'm all for it. I absolutely. And you know, having been privileged to cover the Olympics and cover – go as far back as 98, discovering a wonderful young player who just blew me away named Angela Ruggiero, who's now become, you know, the doyen of American – you know, she's a IOC – is she a member?
She's an IOC member.
I mean, but I remember seeing her coming out of prep school. I could not believe this poise, this astonishing poise in Nagano in 98. She blew me away, Angela Ruggiero. And so, anyway, I know how many, you know, how good we are. So that was
And the sacrifices that these women make because they don't make the $1 million salaries that the NHL players, and they don't have that opportunity.
No, and America should pay, you know, more people should pay attention to what they have given the sports world.
So I want to turn also to another topic that involved women in sports, and it was sort of where the Me Too movement intersected with sports, and that was the trial of former USA gymnastics team doctor Larry Nassar, and he had abused more than 100 of the young women who competed throughout the U.S. gymnastics ranks. And, you know, he has a 60-year jail sentence.
60, that ought to take care of my hope.
Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, you know, and what was so interesting to me was how brave these young women were to speak out. And not just, you know, average athletes. Some of these were Olympic athletes. Like, for instance,
well, our own Allie Raisman.
Yes, I was going to say, and we can hear Allie Raisman talk about that experience.
I don't even still have words because it's horrifying, you know, going inside. And I told my mom right away, and we kind of started talking about it, and I realized, oh my gosh, he molested me. It's a very uncomfortable and disgusting feeling. And then after that, you know, I've said, and I'll say time and time again, I feel USA Gymnastics and the United States Olympic Committee did not handle it well, and they're still not handling it well. And that's why I am speaking out about it.
I can't wrap my head around the sheer numbers involved here. That somehow, some way, that this could have ever gone on as long as it did with so many people. But the whole idea that depravity is unspeakable. It's truly unspeakable. I have not got to the point, Shira, where I'm numbed by these stories at all. Whether it's the entertainment or whether it's sports, I'm still amazed and ashamed for my gender. You know, there are so many perverts of this nature out there that are given free rein and taking advantage of people who just feel hemmed in. Let's face it, these young ladies live in a society, a world, a very restricted world that they want to, and if they want to compete, they want to get do what they love to do and what they're trained to do, they have to go along with this as part of the deal. They keep their mouth shut. That disgusts me.
Well, there's so much more I would have liked to have gotten to. I mean, we didn't even get to Shalane Flanagan winning the New York City Marathon,
yep,
or Serena Williams with her record-setting 23rd.
Winning while pregnant.
Exactly. Winning while 8 weeks pregnant.
No man can make that claim.
That is true. And on that note, Barbara, I would like to say thank you. We'll call you the sports columnist emeritus for the Boston Globe. And you are now also host of Bob Ryan's Boston podcast and a commentator on ESPN. Thank you for coming in, Bob. We'll have to do this again sometime.
Thank you for having me. Anytime, Shira.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Shira Springer, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Shira Springer. Now, let's look back at the year in music.
Yeah. Hey, I remember syrup sandwiches and crime allowances.
In the corner of this black heart, a cold deck of wild cards. Tell me, are you scared to make a band?
Those are some of our favorite songs from 2017. Humble by hip-hop icon Kendrick Lamar, Better Bad Idea from country artist Sonny Sweeney, and, of course, Bach's Goldberg Variation by famed pianist Glenn Gould. Joining me to talk about some of the music in 2017, the best music in 2017, is Tim Riley. He's a music critic with NPR. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Shira.
So let's begin with Glenn Gould playing Bach's Goldberg Variations. The original versions by Gould were released in 1955, right?
That's right.
A box set of these original recordings, and audio of those complete recording sessions was released in 2017. And they have some really cool outtakes.
Very interesting outtakes where you can hear how many takes it took for him to get to the final takes that were used ultimately on the record. And what's fascinating about all these outtakes is you get to hear him exploring the Bach on his own terms and trying to really find that ideal pace and the ideal tone and the ideal color for any given variation.
It really lets you kind of get inside the genius of Gould, right?
Yeah. So for pianists, this is really fascinating, right? It's not for everybody because you're really just hearing a pianist practice, right? And trying to find that ideal sound. But it really does kind of draw the curtain back on what his work process was and reveal him to be this extremely ardent and devoted and curious and creative mind, because he tries things out at different paces. It's very interesting.
Did that surprise you, the fact that he was this ardent, devoted, and curious mind? Was that a new wrinkle to his personality?
No, you could always tell he was really creative, but what you didn't have was the process, mm-hmm, right? And how much repetition it takes to get to polishing and making something really, really good. You have to have so much patience in order to drill down as far as you need to drill down to make it as good as it needs to be.
So what other classical releases stood out to you this past year? Any works by the Boston Symphony Orchestra?
So the BSO is in the middle of a gigantic Shostakovich cycle, which is 15 symphonies, and it is a really stunning and revelatory recordings they're releasing as part of that. But this year, in the spring, they released on their own label live recordings of Brahms' four symphonies, which, of course, is a cornerstone of the repertoire. And most major conductors and symphony their orchestras are going to be releasing this set at some point. But for him, for Andras Nelsons to do it at this point, right in the middle of Shostakovich, makes for a very striking counterbalance because it almost sounds like a different orchestra.
So let's hear a moment. This is Symphony No. 1 in C minor by Brahms, recorded by the Boston Symphony Orchestra. So that was recorded under conductor Andras Nelsons. He's the music director of the Boston Symphony Orchestra. What is unique about the way Nelsons conducts this piece?
Well, so with Brahms, you have just this beautifully engineered, I mean, it's kind of like the Cadillac of symphonic composers. These symphonies are so beautifully engineered, they kind of just run themselves. But what you listen for in any conductor is what kind of warmth, what kind of color, what kind of passion they're going to bring to the climaxes, how they're going to time everything. So you hear a lot of really beautifully sustained tension in these recordings where he's holding back and the ear really wants it to move forward, but then you get this great release when he does get to a climax.
So sort of taming.
Well, it's taming, but it's control. Mm-hmm. And it's very measured and creative control where he's building much more tension into the rhythms than you might normally hear. He has a very, very a sure touch with Brahms, and it's a Brahms that equals any other Brahms that I've ever heard. It's really, really gorgeous.
So let's switch gears a little bit because I hate to say this, but not all of the music news out of the BSO has been good this year. The BSO has said they will no longer work with famed conductors James Levine and Charles Dutoit after both men were accused of sexually assaulting multiple people. Levine had worked for the BSO for 6 years, and Dutoit, I believe, was a popular guest conductor with the symphony. Levine said in the statement that the charges against him are quote-unquote unfounded, and Dutoit's office issued a statement that the accusations have, quote, absolutely no basis in truth. How do you think the BSO handled these accusations?
Among classical musicians, you could sort of just hear the eyes rolling all across our audience right now. I mean, these two figures especially have been especially known among classical musician fans and players as being real toxic figures in terms of the sexual harassment.
So how does it get through? I mean, is it just a question of male genius, you know, and, you know, kind of being given a wide berth?
You know, in the classical realm, with that male conductor being such a traditional authority figure, you have all the attendant pathologies related to those male authority figures, unfortunately. And, you know, it's a good thing that this is finally catching up with some of these people. And it's definitely we're not at the end of the list. I mean, there's definitely more to come. It was very unfortunate, the first statement that Andras Nelsons delivered regarding this, because he said something like,
they didn't believe it existed,
yeah, there's
right?
There's no problem. I have to say, I went and looked it up, and he did release a statement later on. It was during a live interview, and the statement that he put out the day after was much, it did a lot of clarifying, and it was much more kind of on point. I think most of us hope that as a European addressing this American uptick in sexual harassment claims, that he really was just out of his depth and he was caught off guard and he did not speak as eloquently as he might have.
Yeah, and I think another facet of this problem could be the lack of diversity at these type of institutions, at symphonies, and sort of within classical music as a whole. So in October, as I understand and as has been reported, a group of 60 local musicians called on the BSO to diversify its programming to include more works by women and musicians of color. I believe there was only, of all the works they'll play in the 2017-2018 season, I believe only one will be by a woman.
Yeah. And this is a real problem. And I looked up some background on that letter. And one of the most persuasive ends of that argument in that letter is that at Tanglewood, at the Music Center during the summer, they are constantly doing works by people of color, works by women. 30% of the compositions they're playing out at Tanglewood in the summer are devoted to diverse elements. So it's something they have in the repertoire. They have the stuff. They know how to do it. They just need to program it, and they need to make audiences accept it. But,
yeah, I was going to say, you say they need to make audiences accept it. Does it matter to audiences? And that's one question. And then the other question is, should it matter to audiences? It certainly matters to the musicians. That's clear by the 60 that brought it to the attention of the BSO.
Well, yes, absolutely it should matter to audiences, but it should matter in all kinds of different levels, right? We have the same problem in journalism. Most journalism newsrooms, we're fighting to get more representation of women and people of color. And in the classical world, you're dealing with a very white male province, right?
And canon that's obviously very white male, and an audience that is accustomed to hearing that canon.
You know, but any gestures that you make in opposition to that are only going to help enhance and reify all of the good stuff that's already there. It's like museums, you know. We need to say there were painters who were not white males who actually did great painting. We want to see them more in museums. Yes, we need to see this all across the whole spectrum of art.
So one place where women have found massive commercial success is in country music. And I know that, Tim, one of your favorites this year was Sunny Sweeney. She's an artist from Nashville who released her fourth album, Trophy, this year. So let's listen to a clip from one of Sweeney's songs. This is Better Bad Idea off of her album, Trophy.
Or do you have a better bad idea? You always play it safe.
So tell me what happened in country in 2017, and for you, what makes Sunny Sweeney stand out?
Well, there have been just a real, it's been a real uptick year for women in country, and I'm thinking about people like Dorie Freeman and Caroline Jones and Margo Price and Heather Miles and Ashley McBride, and there's a record by someone I just discovered this past week named Angelina Presley, a record called Wrangled, which is going to make my list. Women in country are just really grabbing brass ring and making a lot of really interesting statements. And the thing I like about Sunny Sweeney is that she's doing it within the context of being a kind of a big established corporate female country diva. She still is able to reach out through all the production elements and make a real human connection with her listeners. And people disagree about her, but I think she's actually doing the genre a lot of good.
So also on the pop charts, though, women are seeing massive success. Yeah. And that's even without Beyonce this year, really. So let's take a listen.
Now she say she gon' do what or who? Let's find out and see. Cardi B, you know where I'm at. You know where I be. You in the club just to party. I'm there, I get paid a fee. I be in and out them bands so much I know they tired of me. Honestly.
So that's Cardi B. She became the first solo woman in 19 years to get a number one on the Billboard 100 with Bodak Yellow. And then let's not forget Taylor Swift's album, Reputation, is the best-selling album of the year. And Lorde received critical acclaim for her album, Melodrama, and breakout R&B star SZA saw massive commercial success. So there are a lot of, let's also think, there are a lot of other big artists we don't have time to talk about today. We have Jay-Z's return with the introspective 444 and Eminem's fiery new album Revival. I mean, pick one that sort of stood out to you, whether it was Cardi B or Jay-Z or whomever.
Yeah, in addition to that list, I'd like to add Mary Blige, who released a great album called Strength of a Woman and also made a star turn with a leading role in Mudbound, the movie, and she's gotten nominated for a Golden Globe. And this is, you know, a really tough pivot to make. A lot of people try to make this pivot, and she does so just gloriously. It's a great record. It'll make a lot of lists. The thing that I notice as I'm going over all these critics' lists at the end of the year is that there's so little consensus. Mm. A lot of people are choosing Lord for Album of the Year. A lot of people are choosing St. Vincent. A lot of people are choosing Beck. A lot of people are choosing Kendrick Lamar. But among those people who are choosing those records, there's very little overlap, mm-hmm. right? So certain records getting on a lot of people's lists, but not more than like three or four on many people's lists.
So I'm going to have to disagree slightly because I think there is some consensus around Kendrick Lamar.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he was really the artist that got the most people talking in 2017. And, you know, here's more from the track Humble off his album Damn.
Holla, holla, sit holla, down, holla, little, holla, little. Be humble, holla, sit down, holla, 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 be humble, holla, 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 sit down, holla, little, holla, little. Be humble, holla, sit holla, down.
Tim, we've got 30 seconds here. You're a fan of Kendrick Lamar. What is it about him that you like?
Well, each record is different. So his first record, Good Boy Mad City, is a really strong rap record. Pimp a Butterfly is a very strong concept album and protest record. And this record, Damn, is a pop record. I've talked to Kendrick Lamar fans who talk about how he's already done his protest move. He's done his great rap move. This is a record that really is going to make him more popular with more listeners.
That's Tim Riley, a music critic for NPR. Thanks for joining me, Tim. Love talking about the Goldberg Variations. That's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Kathleen McNerney, Jamie Bologna, and Allison Bruzek, with help from Cassandra Sunt, Zoe Mitchell, and Lily Tyson. Tim Skoog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Shira Springer, and this is Radio Boston.
That he frontin' on women. Get the off my stage, I'm the cement. Get the off my, ay, that ain't right. I make a play blowing up your whole life. I'm so sick and tired of the Photoshop.